I'm Anthony Wright, and I'm your host today on Attunement. And my guest today is Dr. F. David Peet.
Science, the old science was concerned with prediction and control. And really, I think we have to come to terms with the fact that we live in a different sort of universe, that we can't necessarily control the world around us, but maybe there doesn't have to be fear in that lack of control. Maybe it's the idea of the Wu Wei of, you know, going with the flow, seeing, you know, what am I supposed to do in this moment, living in the moment. And I also wanted to propose something I call gentle action, that a lot of our actions have been intrusive, invasive, particularly when we try to do things, you know, in other communities, do things abroad. We view this thing as a problem outside ourselves. We're going to solve the problem, control what's going on. And I think it requires a much more subtle approach, a much more creative and subtle and gentle approach.
Dr. F. David Peet was born in Liverpool, has a PhD in theoretical physics, and is the author of 20 books, as well as plays for radio and stage. He's deeply interested in the relationship between science, art, creativity, and culture. In his latest book, Pathways of Chance, he reflects on the elusive nature of quantum reality, the way language shapes our lives, the world of the Blackfoot, and his life in a medieval Italian village. Welcome, Dr. Peet.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And you have been a rather widely known author in scientific circles and lay circles. From your work beginning with Synchronicity all the way to your latest book called Pathways of Chance, you have really been a translator for those of us lay people who are not deeply engaged with quantum physics.
Yeah, well, you know, in a way, when I was a kid, I used to like to go in the library, and I was desperate to get the adult card so I could go in the adult section and get out books like by Bertrand Russell and people like that, ABC of Relativity and things, you know, those sort of books, and Into Space, a book called Into Space about space travel. So in a way, you know, maybe part of me is writing the books for that kid that used to go in the library, who was enthusiastic and wanted to know about ideas. It's partly that and partly, you know, the old joke that if you want to learn something, you either teach it or write a book about it. So that's another reason.
Yeah. So you actually started out as a chemist at your home.
Yeah. As a kid, yeah, I used to do a lot of chemical experiments. You know, we had a shed at the back of the garden, and I used to do experiments and, you know, dissolve things and make gases. And I felt in some ways, you know, it's a bit like being an alchemist. You know, I was trying to transform matter, finding what's the essence of things. And also occasionally making explosions. And
which your parents didn't appreciate.
Which they didn't. No, they banned me. I needed also to condense gases in the refrigerator and burnt part of the fridge. Another time, you know, this was just after the war, I got some piece of magnesium. Was off an incendiary bomb, and got that ignited, and then it started to burn its way through the floor.
So. And you couldn't put that out.
Couldn't put that out. No.
Oh my goodness. Well, a lot of your work has focused, and your first book was on synchronicity.
Well, actually, no. I did a book before that, which was called The Nuclear Book. It was at the time of Three Mile Island, and the question there was, could the same thing happen to the reactors in Canada? Well, they're called a CANDU reactor, and so it was really looking from both sides at nuclear power, and that was an interesting reaction. The people that were pro-nuclear said, you know, this book's really too critical of nuclear, and the people who are anti-nuclear said, this guy's too much in favor of nuclear, so nobody liked it.
Well, but at least it sounds like you were giving a fairly even and balanced report.
Yeah, I feel now, yeah, in retrospect, yes, it was pretty even, yeah.
So how were you drawn to physics and nuclear physics?
I was always interested in those sort of things. You know, from being a kid, one of my earliest books, I remember my aunt, before I could read and write, was called The Marvels and Mysteries of Science, you know, and she used to open the pages and I'd look in there and see pictures of, you know, planets and the moon and pictures of the atom. And those sort of things excited me. I always wanted to know more. And I decided that's really what I wanted to look at was, you know, the ultimate questions.
Yes, but you kept going outside the box.
That's true, yeah. That was a bit of a problem, yeah. I did research. I went to Queen's University in Canada after getting a PhD, and then I went to the National Research Council of Canada. And I was going pretty well, but then, you know, the advice given to young scientists at that time, and I think still the same thing, is you find a little area where you want to work, and you just keep on publishing papers. where I wanted, you know, something more than that. And I remember I could have a year off, a sabbatical, and writing around and saying, who's doing the most exciting work? And somebody said, Roger Penrose. And at that time, Penrose was in London University. And so I went and spent that year with Penrose, and by chance also happened to meet David Bohm. And so that's how that relationship developed.
And David Bohm has really done some significant work with quantum physics.
Yeah. Well, Bohm was a student of Oppenheimer's, a good friend of Einstein. And, you know, there are the Bohm-Einstein letters. This is amazing. Okay, so you think, here's Einstein, the older man, here's Bohm, the new hope. They're going to write to each other. So what do they write about? They write about their stomachs. You know, if I eat this, I get indigestion. Einstein, yes, I have that problem too. I have terrible indigestion. So that's a very disappointing.
Yes, well, yeah. But so that didn't necessarily provide any insights then.
No, but Dave did tape some memories of Einstein, and there was that discussion they once had where Einstein felt that there had to be an ultimate theory, the final all-embracing theory. And Bohm argued this way. He said, you know, it took us 200 years from Newton to discover the quantum level. It took 200 years to discover that. Under the quantum level may be another level, and that may take a time. And under that level, yet another. So his notion was that reality was endless. It could keep on going below.
Well, and I guess chaos theory really does support that in terms of its infinite dimensionality.
Yeah, well, chaos theory also tells us that there's always missing information, that the dream of physics was, you know, to describe everything, to control everything, to make absolute predictions. And chaos theory has sort of shown us we can't do that.
And wasn't that also Gödel's theorem, that you can't measure something from inside the same system you're trying to measure it?
Yeah, you know, it's very interesting. In 1900, you know, this was the year the president of the Royal Society said that we now know everything there is to know. Science knows everything there is to know. That was 1900. And he did say there was two small clouds on the horizon, and he identified what they were. And it turned out one, you know, blew up into quantum theory, the other into relativity. But he said everything was known that was to be known. In 1900, which is exactly the same year that Max Planck proposed the quantum, and at the same year that Poincaré looked at the solar system, the dynamics of the solar system, and discovered under certain critical conditions it could be chaotic. Mm-hmm. But it had to wait, you know, many decades before chaos theory was born, although the seeds were there in 1900. So, yeah. So everything was there. You know, it's an amazing year for in so many in the arts. It was quite a century, the 20th century.
Yeah, you know? It certainly was.
So many revolutions.
Well, and I know in your book, and you've got a new book coming out, and it's going to be released in the U.S. in, September?
I think September, yeah.
And it's called Pathways of Chance, and they can go on your website and order it there. But you said in your book you did some investigations about the perturbations in an atom in the same way the solar system.
Yeah, well, this is an important point. Einstein, talking to the young Heisenberg, told him that it's the theory that suggests the observables. So I'd like to try and explain that. That there were a group of philosophers around in Vienna called the Viennese Circle, the logical positivists. Their argument was that, you know, you get a series of observations, and a good theory takes a minimum number of steps from those observations to the final theory.
Like Occam's razor, yeah.
Yeah. Now, Einstein says, no, it's not actually the other way around. The theory is a creation of the human imagination, and the theory suggests what you should look at, what you see. And to give an example, that physicists tended to work with systems that were in equilibrium, in balance, with small disturbances, and all that way that the mathematics they used sort of worked perfectly for those systems. So those tended to be the only things they saw. Another example was that Newton had shown how you could describe the motion of the Earth around the Sun, but add a third body, the Moon around the Earth and the Earth around the Sun, and it becomes insoluble. So you do a series of approximations, and that was called perturbation theory. So most of physics used this series of approximations called perturbation theory. And as a result, it only looked at systems where you could sort of apply that, and it ignored others. It had swept them under the carpet, it called them monstrous, or, you know, it didn't want to look at shock waves.
Outliers.
Things called monster curves. It was only when chaos theory came about, it showed you, no, this perturbation theory works under certain conditions. In other conditions, it's all going to blow up. I mean, a famous example are the rings of Saturn. There are gaps in those rings. Why are there gaps in those rings? Because if you put a rock there, it would fly off chaotically. So if you added up all those little series of approximations in that point, it would be infinite. The thing would just fly away.
Because that's where those basins were of not necessarily attraction, but of repulsion.
Yeah. So that's it. So chaos theory really opened a door. So to really reinforce that point, that the scientific theory suggested what we looked at. It sort of, in a subtle way, suggested we're going to look at this part of the universe and ignore that part. With chaos theory, it came along, no, all those things we ignored before, now we find are really interesting. The stock market, ecosystems, all social systems, all sorts of things.
And that began from the study of turbulence, didn't it?
Yeah, well, and another point to make was that it really only sort of burst into the scientific world with the development of the computer, because with a computer you could actually visualize these things. And that's an important point, I think, that science isn't done in the abstract. It's important to be able to see, to visualize these things. And there's a beautiful book, maybe your listeners may like to try and find it, by Martin Kemp, called Visualizations. And what Kemp does is he takes a number of scientific discoveries and shows that in each case, somehow somebody's made a model or a picture of it, or an example would be of DNA. Crick and Watson didn't do that in the abstract. They actually, with clamps and stands, they built an enormous model of a DNA molecule in the laboratory.
I remember this.
Yeah.
Yes.
So it seems as if, seeing is believing, in a sense. Visualization is important. Visualizations by Martin Kemp. I think it's Oxford University Press.
The first chapter of your book really brought me to some of my own personal experience and the first chapter is called Sensing in the Body, and it's about memory and the programming of the cells. You speak about internal sensations, because I want to move into the art realm.
Yeah, yeah.
And that Cézanne, actually, the painter Cézanne, used internal sensations as the source for his art.
Yes. He had this remark that, I sit at the riverbank and now I move my head a little to the left, a little to the right, and the motives multiply, and it's always more painful to realize my sensations. So that was the thing, to realize his sensations. He spoke about that, these sensations. And if you ever had gone to a retrospective of Cézanne and seen hundreds and hundreds of canvases, you see very, very few are signed. And the ones that are signed were those where he realized. He also said that he felt he was the consciousness of nature spoke through him, and he became the consciousness of nature. And in a similar way, David Bohm used to talk about how he felt sensations in his body when he was doing the mathematics, doing the physics. And he talked about spin. He felt one sensation, then another one, then something else completely different. And that related to some theorems about the spin of the electron. And he spoke to Einstein, and Einstein said when he worked on the field equations, he had a little rubber ball, he'd squeeze it, and he'd feel the sensations in his arm and the muscular sensations. So there's that sense of sensations, almost part of the thinking, that the thinking process isn't just all up here in the brain. It's through, my belief is it's throughout the whole body, mm-hmm. and that somehow we project outwards something that's been going on inside, and then we begin to see it objectively. There it is out there. I can objectify it. I see what it is, and I take it back in again, and it moves around and comes out again, and it's an interesting process.
So you've had these experiences yourself when you're processing.
And before we started this conversation, we were talking about Glenn Gould.
Oh, yes.
And Glenn Gould had this experience of trying to play this piece of Bach, and his hearing of it was interfering with the process. So he put the radio on, loud on the piano, and he let the body was doing the playing, but he didn't want to hear what he was playing.
We're going to take a short break, and I'm Anthony Wright. I'm your host today on Attunement, and we're talking with my guest, Dr. F. David Peet. And Dr. Peet, how can people contact you? And you have an institute in Italy?
Yes, it's in Pari, Italy, which is, Pari is just south of Siena, and they can look at the at paricenter.com, P-A-R-I, and center's spelt the American way.
And you're giving some seminars this fall?
Yep, yeah, well, in May and in September.
Great. All right, we're going to take a short break, and we're going to be right back. I'm Anthony Wright, and I'm your host today on Attunement, and my guest is Dr. F. David Peet. The second chapter of your book is Quantum Strangeness. I think even in today's world, so many people are conditioned to the Newtonian notion of how things work. And one of the big questions that I had for you was, how do we practically move? I mean, many people who listen to this show have heard, have seen the movie What the Bleep, but they don't quite know what to do with that.
Yeah.
And how do we move from the macro world of the cosmos and, you know, common everyday stuff down into the quantum world with all of the strangeness that goes on there from the involvement and the wholeness with the mind?
Well, it's very, very difficult. And in fact, you know, one of the things that David Bohm and his colleague used to say was that scientists come to praise Bohr. Niels Bohr was the father of the interpretation of quantum mechanics, and to decry Einstein, because Einstein, although he'd done relativity, was still really couldn't accept the quantum theory. So that's it. The scientists come to praise Bohr and decry Einstein, but they end up thinking like Einstein and ignoring Bohr. And that's practically, yes. The quantum theory is incredibly subtle and very difficult to really get to grips with. And very few physicists, I think, have really read what Bohr said about it. I mean, one of the things Bohr pointed out was that if we try to talk about the quantum world, we're using everyday language, ordinary language, whatever it is, German or English or French. And that language contains all sorts of assumptions about space and time and causality that we sort of import those in. So we want to talk about that world down there, and as soon as we begin to speak, we're just using words, everyday language, that really applies to large-scale things. See, I wrote a book called Einstein's Moon, in which I was trying to explain a particular phenomenon in the quantum world. And I found every time I wanted to say when two particles are far apart, they remain correlated. And I think, but wait a minute, far apart, that's a large-scale idea. It's a concept in our world. How do I say this? How do I write this down? And I came to see what Bohr had famous remark of Bohr, that we're suspended in language so that we don't know what is up and what is down.
I seem to remember hearing some of the short clips you have on your website where he talks about that very thing.
Yeah. And then another thing is, to go a little bit further, David Bohm made this point that the Newtonian worldview, the worldview that the classical worldview, the worldview that we all sort of adhere to is objects nicely isolated in space and time, you know, well-defined and interacting through forces. Okay, so, you know, a magnet and a piece of metal, the magnet's well-defined, the metal's well-defined, and there's a magnetic pull from one to the other. Now, he also noted that our language that we speak, European languages, are very much noun, subject, object, predicate, noun, verb, noun. You know, the cat chases the mouse. So you have the cat, a well-defined concept, a mouse, something else well-defined in space, and an activity, one chases the other. And Bohm had always felt, suppose, but the quantum world is much closer to a world of processes, unfolding and enfolding. What if we had a language like that? And he did write about that, and he called it the Rio mode, the flowing mode. But towards the end of his life, we'd organized a meeting with Native American elders. There were Blackfoot people there, and Bohm learned that the Blackfoot language is very much a verb-based language. It's a strong but verb-based language. And the Blackfoot worldview is everything is process and flux. Everything is changed. Nothing is constant. Even your name will change during your life because, you know, you've done something, you now have a new name. So I think in the last months of his life, it was amazing for Bohm to realize that there was a civilization that used that language that he'd always dreamt about, this language in which you're not dominated by nouns, by objects, but it's a language of process, and that their worldview was a process worldview, which is very like the quantum worldview, that everything is in flux, it's unfolding and enfolding. So really, you know, to say, could we embrace a quantum world would almost be like having to speak another language.
Well, and yet is it legitimate to say that if we can adjust our awareness to, instead of presupposing the Newtonian world, if we can adjust our awareness to the fact that the lamp that's standing here is an event, that it is a process.
It's a process, yeah.
And if we can just wrap our mind around that, is that going to be more accurately attending to the quantum world?
I think it would. But, you know, and Bohr said this with suspended language, and Wittgenstein too. Wittgenstein said all the great problems of philosophy, the traditional great issues of philosophy, are really pseudo-problems because they're created by language. You know, we're going to talk about consciousness. You use the word the mind in one way. I use it in another way. But we're both saying mind, and we both think we're talking about the same thing. In fact, we're all talking about something different because we're using... Wittgenstein said, don't ask what the word means... ask how it's used. So this, how you're using it. And I've been to scientific meetings where people talk about consciousness. You know, can we describe, can we define consciousness? This person's talking about some cognitive strategies. That person over there is talking about something completely different.
Uh-huh.
You know, so, but they all, but because they're using the same words, they believe they're all speaking about the same thing. I mean, a really, good example, there was a book written, and several people like Stephen Hawking, myself, the Vatican astronomer, we all have to write about God, you know, and everybody sees God as a noun, as an object, you know. So, I mean, what if God's a verb? What if God's a process? I mean, that's all a bit silly, but, you know, the fact that this thing, God, is a concept, it's limited, we've limited it. We see it as a noun.
By the language itself, yes.
If you look at the mystical traditions, no, because they don't play those sort of games. But so the language is a thing we really have to be careful about.
So then, if we could just change the way we use language, we'd be able to change our way that we interrelate with the universe.
Yeah, and I think, maybe the people who play with language are the poets. The stand-up comedians. I mean, I'm serious about that. I always admired Lenny Bruce because Lenny Bruce was trying to draw people's attention to the way they use language and the way they misuse language. Mm-hmm. And it was Confucius who was asked at a very crucial time in China, what do we do? He said, first purify the language.
Okay. Yeah. I've been a student of hypnosis for many, many years for this very point. So in a manner of speaking, then... we're all in a sort of trance by that kind of language that we use.
Yeah, I know Gurdjieff said, the thing is, there's a man on a runaway horse, how do you wake him up? Maybe you can wake him up for a moment, but then he goes back to sleep again. So he compared most of us to people on runaway horses.
That were sleeping.
That were sleeping, yeah. So how do you wake?
I also wanted, being that you've spoken about Confucius, I've been a practitioner of the I Ching for many years, and I've come to understand, there's a book by Katya Walter called The Tao of Chaos, and one of the things that I've come to understand about the I Ching, because you draw the yarrow stalks in the given moment, and you don't know how, I mean, it's kind of determined by chance, but chance is another linguistic descriptor. But it seems to me that doing the I Ching is a way of measuring the collapse of the quantum wave function of the personality in the given moment. Would you say that that's true?
Yeah. It's interesting that Carl Jung said that causality is the prejudice of the West and chance is the prejudice of the East. And I like that idea in the I Ching that when you're casting it and you're making this pattern of broken and unbroken lines, that somehow it's an image in the present of the eternal. You know, there's the eternal, and within this moment, there's a little image being reflected. So it's not really predicting the future. I wouldn't say predicts the future. For me, I would think it's showing the possibility inherent in the present for the future.
Oh, that's very well said.
Yeah.
But it does collapse a quantum wave function. And we're going to have to take a quick break, but I'd like to talk to you after the break about the collapse of the quantum wave function by the attention. I'm Anthony Wright, and I'm your host today on Attunement, and I'm talking with my guest, Dr. F. David Peet, and he's got a new book out. You've got a new book out called Pathways of Chance, and it's an autobiographical book about your experience through your life. And how can people contact you, Dr. Peet?
Oh, well, they could go to the website, which is www.paricenter.com, or my own website, which is fdavidpeet.com.
And the last name is spelled
P-E-A-T, yeah.
Well, we're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back. I'm Anthony Wright, and I'm your host today on Attunement, and we are talking with my guest physicist and author, Dr. F. David Peet. And Dr. Peet has written a new book called Pathways of Chance. And before the break, Dr. Peet, you talked about the prejudice of the West being...
causality.
Causality.
Yeah.
and the prejudice of the East being chance. I'd like to ask you more now about the collapse of the quantum wave function by the application of the attention.
Okay, well, first of all, I have to explain what the wave function is. A quantum system is described by what's called a wave function. Now, in our world, you know, a thing is either on the table or on the floor or whatever, you know, the cat is either alive or dead. But in the quantum world, you're allowed all possible combinations of two events. And there's a famous paradox called the Schrödinger cat paradox, where you put a cat in the box, and there's a quantum device in there with a 50% chance of decaying within 1 hour. So at the end of an hour, there's a 50-50 chance that this quantum device has gone off. And when it goes off, it can trigger a release of cyanide, which will kill the cat. So in our world, we say, well, the cat is either alive or dead, and we don't know till we open the box. But in the quantum world, the cat is alive, it's dead, it's 50% alive and 50% dead, it's 99% dead and 1% alive, all possibilities. But of course, when you open the box, you only see one result. And that's called the collapse of the wave function. So the thing is, the theory says that that all possible combinations are present, but when we make an observation, we only see one. So the question is, what collapsed the wave function? What picked out one solution from all the others? And there are several. There are several explanations given. One explanation is called the multiple universes, that in fact, every time you collapse the wave function, part of you goes up in one universe where there's a dead cat, and another part of you goes off into another universe where there's a live cat, and universes keep branching over and over and over again.
And chaos theory actually describes this in a bifurcation fashion.
Now the thing about that is it seems a totally stupid and absurd theory. The reason it's popular is at the Big Bang, there was a wave function. And what collapsed a wave function at the Big Bang? So the idea is, yes, the universe started branching from the Big Bang, because there's nobody around to do the measurement. There's nobody around to do an observation at the moment of the creation of the universe. Nobody there to do it. So that's very popular amongst some physicists. The other possibility is that it's human consciousness that collapses a wave function, that the human being opens a box, looks in, and collapses a wave function. But then you could say, okay, suppose I videotape, I have a robot open the box, and I videotape it. What happens then? Well, some people would seriously say that when a human being sticks that tape in a VCR and watches the experiment, at that moment the wave function collapses. So there are people who would take that point. So you've really got like two absurd extremes. One is that retroactively I can watch a videotape of a quantum experiment and collapse a wave function maybe 10 years after it's happened. And another one is that there's lots and lots of branching multiple universes. So I'm unhappy with both of those. I don't like either of them. Then there are people like David Bohm who wanted to adopt what he called a realistic or causal interpretation, in which you don't get that paradox. But then you sacrifice other things. You say the electron really is a little object that is being guided by information about the experimental situation. And then at the second level of the theory, the electron is a process of folding and unfolding. So, but Bohm presents...
But by observation.
No, you don't need... In Bohm's theory, you don't need to have a human observer there.
Oh, okay.
No, you don't need to, because it's all causal, all the way down. Now, I would say that, you know, the mainstream physicists would not accept that. Well, or put it this way, you know, maybe 20 years ago, mainstream physicists would scoff at it. Maybe now it's got a little more attention, and there are physicists who do work with Bohm's ideas. Mm-hmm. But it just suggests to us that this is a very mysterious world, the quantum world.
Yes,
and we still haven't got to grips with it properly.
One of the things that I wanted to ask you about too is your ideas and observations about M theory or string theory. As an effort to unify quantum and Einstein's theories.
Well, you know, and a thing called supersymmetry. How do you unify all the abstract symmetries in nature? The idea of superstrings was a neat one. That you see you see a pattern of elementary particles, and they're a little bit like musical overtones. You know,
this was why it was so tremendously attractive to me.
Yeah, so they're a bit like overtones. You press a note on a piano, you hear that note, but you also hear all the various overtones, and those overtones give what makes a piano different from a violin or a trumpet. It's the pattern of the overtones. And so the idea was, well, maybe the fundamental particles are not little point particles. Maybe they're vibrating. They're like little vibrating strings. And the strings can vibrate, you know, in different modes and produce a spectrum of the elementary particles. And that was a great idea. And superstrings was that idea. But then it started off like that, but then it got more and more complex. It got complicated. And I think...
Because I know there were five different versions of it, and then somebody finally came up with a sixth version that encompassed all five, and you had to have 10 different dimensions.
All of that, yeah. I mean, I suppose at that point I sort of lost interest in following it. you know, the thing about it, you know, when I did talk to Michael Green, who was one of the two inventors of string theory, and this I'm talking about 20 years ago, I talked to him, maybe 15, 20 years ago, and he did say, you know, when Einstein developed the theory of relativity, he spent a lot of time reading the philosopher David Hume, reading Kant, reading Ernst Mach, thinking deeply, and then inevitably the theory followed. But he felt that the superstring theory was really a very interesting mathematical approach to solve a problem, but it didn't have that deep inevitability that was associated with something like Einstein's theory of relativity. So somehow maybe the theory lacks a great deal of elegance. I don't know. Who am I to criticize it? You know, I mean, I could say yes. I followed it for a time, and I even wrote a book called Superstrings. but then after that, no, I didn't follow anymore.
One of the things that pops out in the notes that I've made about your book was that you used to play skiffle music.
That's right. Yeah, I had a skiffle group. I played the percussion. When I say percussion, I can't say drums because we didn't have any drums. I had brushes and sticks and I played biscuit tins. But I should add that at my last birthday, my wife brought me a snare drum. So now I can turn professional.
Oh, that's fantastic.
But yes, and my father used to tell me about his apprentice, this young kid he had who had his own group. Then he said, you know, he's come to me and he says he's quitting. He's going to Hamburg. I said, George Harrison, you're going to come on your hands and knees and beg for your job back. But George never did.
One of the things, too, that you had spoken about in your book was the marriage of art and science.
Yes.
And I wanted to come back to that and to ask you about that and what your feelings are about that.
Yeah, well, you know, that again began for me when I was at school. I mean, my passion was for science, but there was an art teacher, I think, who was very, very good, because he used to come and talk to me, and we'd look at things, and he'd say, what do you think of that, Pete? And he treated me as an equal, you know, which is a wonderful thing for a teacher to do. And I always had that interest in art, and in talking to artists and meeting artists. And in England, you know, now I've had many conversations with two artists, Anish Kapoor and Anthony Gormley, in the States with Jenny and Anthony, and I do think that there are very, very interesting parallels between art and science. I mean, for example, in physics or mathematics, there's that idea about beauty. You see, a good theory should be elegant and beautiful. And Roger Penrose said, when you don't know what to do, try and do the most beautiful thing possible. And he said, beauty is a means to an end, and beauty is also an end in itself. And the famous mathematician said, Hardy, said that we do mathematics for the beauty. That's why we do it. So it's not a utilitarian thing. It's not, you know, because we want to solve something and, you know, make a bit of money. You do it for the beauty. And I think the greatest physics is like that too. It has to be beautiful. It has to be elegant. It has to be inevitable. So it does, in that sense, it does share some things with art. Although I'm not too sure if beauty and art and beauty and mathematics are the same thing. But but there's that pursuit of inevitability, everything that fits perfectly.
Well, and you also talked about your attraction and your first exposure to Bach in your book.
Oh, right, yeah.
And that must have really captured you.
Yeah, it was interesting because, I mean, skiffle, and then I got interested in New Orleans jazz, and then into modern jazz and Dave Brubeck and the Modern Jazz Quartet. And I had this record where the Modern Jazz Quartet played softly as in a morning sunrise. and they said that it opens with a canon from Bach's Musical Offering. So I didn't know what a canon was, but I went out and got Bach's Musical Offering and was amazed, and it opened a whole world to me and has been ever since, you know. And I'm very, very lucky that near to where I live in this medieval village, very nearby is Maestro Hans Dentler, who is a famous cellist and has also written a book about Bach's Art of Fugue, and he's now writing one on Bach's Musical Offering, and showing how that music is really inspired by Pythagorean ideas, Pythagorean number mysticism, by the notion of Kepler's planetary motions. And so,
and it goes all the way back to the divine monochord.
Yeah, yeah. All of that's there in Bach, and that interest that he was a member of a society, a musical society, which Handel was also a member. And later on, after their death, Mozart joined it, and it was a society that studied Pythagorean teachings. And the mysticism, number mysticism, yeah.
My goodness. So tell us about where you live.
Oh, yes, it's a beautiful little village. It's south of Siena. And in fact, it has a nickname, Little Siena. It's a medieval village, very, very well preserved. It's up on a hill. We're about 400 feet up. And are surrounded by woods with wild boar and pheasant and deer and vineyards around and olive trees and... So, you know, we lived there for a number of years, and the building at the top was it was originally a part of a castle, and it was turned into a school and was abandoned. And the local council decided to clean it up again, and I'd had a conference of artists and scientists in London and was given some money to try and run another conference on the future of the universities. And we are going to run it in London or New York. And I thought, why don't we run it in the village? So that's it. That's how we started. We ran one conference. The local people said we liked it so much, having new faces. Please do more events. So that's how the Parry Center started.
Okay. And what a beautiful place to have scientific conferences, because all of that beauty certainly does go to stimulate deep thinking.
And the motto we adopted is from Carlo Levi, the future has an ancient heart. So we don't just talk about science, we talk about ethics and ethics in business and the future of publishing. Yeah, we had a number of different conferences.
Well, I'm Anthony Wright, and I'm your host today on Attunement, and I'm talking with my guest, Dr. F. David Peet, and he's got a new book called The Pathways of Chance. And how did you come to name this The Pathways of Chance?
Well, because I couldn't help observing people who had all their life mapped out in front of them. You know, I'm going to retire at 65. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. And for me, it's as if it only makes sense if I look backwards and think, oh, I came along that path, and then I suddenly went off in that direction. Then I went in this direction. Here I am now. But as how I got to this medieval village of Parry, I mean, there's no sense in that. No. It was a series of chance, but maybe there was more than chance. If we're going to talk about the I Ching, you know, maybe it was more than chance. Maybe I was directed to turn left rather than right.
And that brings me to this notion of the implicate order that David Bowen talked about.
Yeah.
And that there's this underlying harmony that we may not be able to attend to because it's perhaps multidimensional. Would you say that's right?
Yeah. It's we sort of see the explicate order around us as being the reality, but for Bowen... Underlying that is this implicate order. It's where everything is enfolded, everything connects to everything else. Things interconnect, and mind and matter are not separate. You used to give this nice little analogy of a magnet. You know, you have a bar magnet with a north pole one side, a south on the other. You cut the magnet in half, you don't just get a north pole and then over there a south pole. You get a half a magnet with a north and a south, a north and a south. So you can't, and the same thing with matter and mind. You can't just cut them apart. They're always unified.
Yes, and I think that's one of the things about moving into the new paradigm of thinking out of the old Newtonian subject-object, is that people can perhaps come to a different and deeper awareness with embracing the notion of holism and holographic, the holographic paradigm.
Yes.
So we're going to have to take a short break here. I'm Anthony Wright. I'm your host today on Attunement, and we're talking with my guest, Dr. David Peet. And how can people contact you, Dr.?
Oh, just go to the website, www.fdavidpeet.com or parricenter.com. P-A-R-I, Parry.
Great. So we'll be right back. I'm Anthony Wright, and I'm your host today on Attunement, and we're talking with my guest, Dr. F. David Peet. And Dr. Peet has just written a book called Pathways of Chance that will be available in September of this year in the U.S., but people can order it off of your website. Well, we come to the last part of the interview, and I've been kind of saving this topic because you're going to speak about it tonight at the California Institute of Integral Studies. Talk to us about synchronicity.
Well, synchronicity, yeah. That's,
it was the title of your first book.
Yeah. It was a term coined by the psychologist Carl Jung, but really it was the collaboration of the depth psychologist Jung and the physicist Wolfgang Pauli. The two of them really helped together to develop this idea. And it's, you know, earlier in this conversation I mentioned that the prejudice of the West is causality, and synchronicity is an acausal event. So it was defined as an acausal connecting principle or a meaningful coincidence. So it's two things that happen together that have a deep meaning. So you could have a dream and something happens in the outer world, connects. Or you have you're thinking about something and the phone rings and there's that person you were thinking about. So it connects an inner event to an outer event, but there is no causal connection. There's no causal explanation. It's acausal, but it has to be meaningful. It has to be numinous. There has to be some quality about it. And I don't know if your listeners would know much about the Jungian archetypes, but Jung's idea is that there are structuring principles to the psyche, and which he calls the archetypes. And they show up in behavior, they show up in fairy stories, in myths, they show up maybe in things, objects like mandalas. And the notion is that maybe if sometime in your life you become trapped in one of the archetypes, you know, you've come into the grip of the archetype, you tend to maybe live in a sort of, you could say, a frozen time, and you're always connected to the past. But the synchronicity comes along, and it acts to break you free. It connects you to the future. So synchronicities, the big synchronicities, the important ones, are ways of breaking into the future. So they don't happen that often, and they happen under certain conditions. Sometimes when, you know, you're at your wit's end, you just don't know what to do next, you're desperate, and a synchronicity will occur, or they may occur, you know, in adolescence or around the age of 40. I also like to connect them to other things. To James Joyce had the notion of epiphanies, that there's a certain word or an action, something happens, and you presented with an enormous pattern. And he uses that in his short stories, The Dubliners, in particular the one called The Dead, where at the end of the book, the man is overwhelmed by a feeling of love that he's never experienced before. And because he's learned that his wife was not exactly in love, but very attracted to a man who died. And at that moment, the snow falls, and he realizes the snow is falling all over Ireland. It's falling on the living and the dead. And the living and the dead suddenly become united. And also with the idea from Gerard Manley Hopkins, the poet and Jesuit priest, of inscape, that he felt that in every living thing that there is something vibrant, an authentic voice in every living thing, and that in stress is the force which unites us with that, so that we do have a sense of being connected with the outer world and the inner world. So several people have had that idea. It's not just Carl Jung, but pose it in different ways.
Mm-hmm. 'Cause I was talking with, I cannot remember who it was, but in a way, to me, it seems that the I Ching is a synchronous event. And also, in a way, if one attends to how life unfolds in the moment, that in a way, life itself is synchronous in the present moment. Would you say that's true?
Yeah, and certainly the I Ching would fall very nicely into that idea. It presents you with a pattern, and the pattern corresponding to the pattern is a reading of the situation that you're in, and you know, maybe there's danger, maybe there's progress, but it's not a causal connection. It doesn't define the future in a causal sense, as like a law of physics.
But it does offer an insight into the iteration that's occurring.
It offers a different sort of way. Yeah, it offers an insight. You see, the same thing you could say if you're in the grip of the archetype, and suddenly you have a synchronicity. But under a similar circumstances, you may not have a synchronicity. So
that's as numinous as that you're speaking of. Yeah,
this numinous experience. Maybe you have it. Maybe you don't. So this was the thing that Pauli always stressed, that it was not repeatable in the scientific sense. In the scientific sense, you apply a force and you always get the same result. In the sense of the psyche, no. In some cases, you may get this numinous experience. In other cases, not.
It would be impossible for Jung to open the window and have the scarab beetle fly into, you know, in the classic example to his client a second time.
Yeah.
So, well, we're getting near the end of the hour here, and I thank you so much for being with us. What can you offer our listeners in terms of being able to attend to the new scientific paradigm, the new quantum paradigm in their everyday life, more perhaps, as we spoke earlier about process?
Well, you know, process is one thing. Another thing would be that science, the old science was concerned with prediction and control. And really, and I think we have to come to terms with the fact that we live in a different sort of universe, that we can't necessarily control the world around us, but maybe there doesn't have to be fear in that lack of control. Maybe it's the idea of the Wu Wei of, you know, going with the flow, seeing, you know, what am I supposed to do in this moment, living in the moment. And I also wanted to propose something I call gentle action, that a lot of our actions have been intrusive, invasive, particularly when we try to do things, you know, in other communities, do things abroad. We view this thing as a problem outside ourselves. We're going to solve the problem, control what's going on. And I think it requires a much more subtle approach, a much more creative and subtle and gentle approach. I think that's what we need to do. And that's going to be the subject of my next book, Gentle Action, it's going to be called.
So you're talking literally about the art of living.
Yeah, and also the importance of trust and ethics in our lives, in every day, trust in the marketplace, trust in business, trust in your everyday actions too, that we need more trust.
Well, in some of the tapes I've listened to of his, Alan Watts continues to talk about trusting one's own life.
Yeah.
And just in the natural pattern that is perhaps present in the implicate order, but not yet unfolded or iterated yet.
Right, right, yeah.
So it's a real deep trust that way. Well, we're at the end here, so thank you so much for being with us. I'm Anthony Wright, and I'm your host today on Attunement, and we've been talking with my guest, Dr. F. David Peet. Your new book, again, is The Pathways of Chance. How can people contact you?
Oh, just go to the website, paricenter.com, P-A-R-I, and center, spelled the American way.
Great. Well, thank you so much for being with us, Dr. Peet.
Thank you.
I'm Anthony Wright. I'm your host today on Attunement, and we've been talking with my guest, Dr. F. David Peet. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.